Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been charged by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office with murder and with manslaughter.
It is the news. A city in pain has waited for all week. An arrest in the killing of George Floyd. Video of his death while in custody of four Minneapolis police officers, sparking days of protests, rioting, and destruction of more than 170 businesses there. Tonight, we look at the many issues that tell the story of this American tragedy. My guests are former Prince George's County State's Attorney Glenn Ivey, Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, and Nikki Mayo, President of the Baltimore Association of Black Journalists. Lines are open if you have a comment, if you have a question about this very difficult issue. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Thank you all for joining this conversation. I want to start with Glenn Ivey. Glenn, why did this take so long? And certainly that may be subjective because some people were expecting that an arrest should have been on the same day that the officers were arrested. I mean, were fired.
Yeah, no, it's a critical question. I think when the prosecutor announced the charges today, the point he made to the press was that for a police use of excessive force case, this is exceptionally fast. Over these cases, these investigations take, 9 months to a year or longer. So doing it in 4 days is pretty fast. They had a conviction the year before, the same office, for a police officer killing a woman. The officer's name was Muhammad Noor. It took a year to charge that case. So obviously, here it's stronger. You have everything on videotape, so that helps a lot. I think there's some issues that might pop up, and we'll probably talk about those later with respect to the medical examiner and the toxicology issues. But, by most standards, this is pretty fast in a police excessive force case.
The charges so far are third-degree murder and manslaughter. Since I spoke to you earlier today on Facebook Live, I've had some friends, some associates, and people who follow me on social media raising the question, why not first-degree murder? Why not second-degree murder? Why third-degree murder? And what's this manslaughter business? Can you explain that for us?
Sure. The first-degree murder is, malice aforethought. It's, like a hitman kind of scenario. Police officers are almost never charged with that when they're acting in the line of duty, even when they go way beyond the lines of where they're supposed to, as you have here. The second-degree, third-degree murder is a tougher line, I think. The point I made about the case from last year, they charged that officer with second-degree murder. The jury acquitted on second-degree but convicted on third-degree. So that might be in the back of their minds. Third-degree murder is depraved heart, which is where most people call it. There they call it depraved mind, but it's acting with such recklessness and in a way that's imminently dangerous that it leads to the charge. The manslaughter charge, I think, is a fallback. That's a sort of a negligence, creating an unreasonable risk type of charge. I think that's the charge they put out there in case things go south during the trial. But I think their hope and expectation is that they could get a conviction for third-degree murder.
I also want to talk about the other officers, because while you said that this happened quickly, the arrest of Derek Chauvin, there were three other officers with him. There's new video that came out today that showed two of the four officers kneeling or appearing to kneel on the back and on the legs of George Floyd. And I know this sounds so simple for those of us who are not lawyers, but one would assume that if you've arrested one who was there, why not arrest the whole bunch at once?
Well, I think, you know, there could be a variety of reasons for that. I think one is that Chauvin seems to be way more culpable than the rest of them because he had his knee on the neck, which is inherently dangerous, as the complaint pointed out. At the other extreme was an officer who I think, and the prosecutors, I think, will really try and use this at trial. But he was the one saying, and you can hear it on the body cams, hey, shouldn't we put him on his side? You know, sort of reaching out to Chauvin. He's saying he can't breathe, basically. Shouldn't we put him on his side to make sure that nothing bad happens with respect to his breathing? And the other two, I think, are in the middle. I think you could end up with all four of them being charged. But the officer who raised to put him on the side piece, I think, could end up being more helpful to the prosecution than the defense down the line.
Mm-hmm. Earlier today, and as a matter of fact, it was literally about an hour or so ago, President Trump made his first comments about the situation in Minnesota. And, you know, he did make some comments earlier this week, but more specifically, he was responding to a tweet that he made last night about the protests and the rioting. And that tweet said, you know, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And then he backed up off of that today. This is what he said when asked at the White House about that.
Well, I've heard that phrase for a long time. I don't know where it came from, where it originated. I view that phrase as...
In 1967, the Miami police...
Well, I don't know. I've also heard from many other places, but I've heard it for a long time, as most people have been. Frankly, it means when there's looting, people get shot and they die. And if you look at what happened last night and the night before, you see that it's very common. And that's the way that was meant, and that's the way I think it was supposed to be meant. But I don't know where it came from. I don't know where it originated. I wouldn't know a thing like that. But I will say it's very accurate in the sense that when you do have looting, like you had last night, people often get shot. And they die, and that's not good, and we don't want that to happen.
Dr. Greg Carr, the reference was made to unrest in 1967 in Miami, a police chief making these racially charged comments. Can you give us a little bit more context for that statement?
Well, of course. I'm glad to be on, and glad to be on with the other guests.
Thank you so much.
Yes, the Walter Headley was the police chief of Miami at the time in 1967. And we have to understand that 1967 saw the continuation of summer unrest, kind of kicked off in 1965 in the white section of L.A. And then 1966, 67, subsequent year, they called them the long, hot summers during that period. And, of course, the following April, when Dr. King was killed, over 100 cities went up in smoke, parts of them, including Washington, D.C. Chief Headley in Miami was squarely in the middle of a kind of law and order surge in this country. Remember, the Vietnam War is going on. Within a couple of years, Richard Nixon will be in the White House and continue that. And he also said at the time, we don't mind being accused of police brutality. They haven't seen anything yet. Donald Trump, and when he said he wasn't aware of where it came from, that could be true given his addled mind generally in terms of his memory. But in terms of his use of the phrase, of course, that was very intentional. He didn't walk it back as much as he obfuscated from a very deliberate tweet. And, of course, what we're seeing happening in Minnesota is similar to what we saw in the 1960s. We remember the Kerner Commission report, which came in the middle of these kind of insurrections. 1967, of course, saw what happened in Detroit as well, going up in flames. So finally, what we see is that mass action has forced the hand of the state. When we heard the charge today from Mike Freeman, the Hennepin County District Attorney, we also saw the seeds of what will probably be the defense of this officer, indefensible officer, in saying that the preliminary report from the medical examiner says this guy has all these underlying health conditions, and there's no evidence as of yet that the knee on the neck caused his death. It could have been some of the other things. So I guess what I'm saying in conclusion is that Trump issued, as he has been issuing since he's been in office, a rallying cry to his white nationalist base to say that, you know, if this continues, we will exert force, which is the function of the police in this society, which is to enforce order through the use of force.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are examining the killing in Minneapolis, the death of George Floyd. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's go to Walter, calling from D.C. Walter, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just want to say this. Does this remind you of the Charlottesville rally where you had the you had all these hate groups marching and someone ran over a crowd of people and Heather Heyer was the victim of it? Does this remind you that what happened then could have a backlash with Trump when voting comes around, that they lost the midterm election? And I'll hang them and let you guys talk about this. You guys have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I will say that there was an incident in Denver, because there are protests going on all over the country right now, from New York to Los Angeles. We're seeing them in Washington, D.C. There was an incident in Denver yesterday where someone drove a car or some kind of vehicle into a crowd, and no one was hurt there. I think that's the only similarity that we have seen there. And I would not venture to equate these demonstrators with the white nationalists and neo-Nazis that we saw in Charlottesville. But certainly, Glenn, if you have a thought about that, and then Dr. Carr, go right ahead.
I think the caller's point was that Trump is excusing the inexcusable. So in Charlottesville, it was the neo-Nazis. And I think he said something like there were good people on both sides was the comment he made at the time, which was just, you know, shocking that he could even for him, I think. But, you know, to this point, the looting and shooting comment, maybe he didn't know the history, but he really should have known better anyway. And I think it's those types of statements, his attack on the mayor of Minneapolis and the governor subsequently, they're all destructive. And, you know, this is just the MO for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Carr, your thoughts about what the caller was talking about?
I agree with Brother Ivy. Certainly we didn't hear Donald Trump say that there are very fine people on both sides in defense of the people who are in the streets in Minnesota. Of course, we understand that in Minneapolis, which is about 60% white and 40% non-white, about a fifth of Minneapolis-St. Paul area is black of various backgrounds. And then you have a large Latinx and Native American community, among others, an Asian community. It's a multicultural group out there, and it's predominantly white. This makes it very difficult for Donald Trump, but what he's couching this in, all of this, everything, including the COVID-19 moment, Donald Trump is thinking about one thing. He's thinking about his political fortunes and reelection. So you've already seen him threaten the state of Minnesota with withholding funds, Michigan as well. You've seen them try to attack the post office and voter and absentee balloting. This is all part of the strategy. Donald Trump has dropped all facades, and now his idea is he's going to rally his base. So it was a white nationalist cry, and to compare it to his remarks and in the wake of what happened in Charlottesville, I think it's absolutely appropriate, because he certainly called himself defending the white nationalists who rallied on the steps of many Capitol state houses over the last month, a calling to reopen America, so to speak. So this is all part of a reelection campaign strategy, and this is just the beginning stages of it as far as he's concerned.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. James from Columbia, what's on your mind?
Yes, I thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question that I haven't heard anybody else mention yet. The four former officers were on Mr. Floyd until an ambulance arrived. Now, why would they have to call an ambulance for him before he had passed away? I mean, he was supposedly being arrested for a fraudulent check. So why were they calling an ambulance? It doesn't make any sense.
Thank you so much for that. I only have about a minute or so, but if you can, Glenn, just speak to that, because we do know now from what we're hearing in the charging documents, that George Floyd was non-responsive, to put a fine point on it. He was deceased by the time the ambulance got there. Can you talk a little bit more from a legal perspective about that?
Yeah, I think, and you can hear the comments on the video from the bystanders. He stops moving. You know, it appears that he's dead. The complaint that the prosecutor issued says that he'd been non-responsive for 2 or 3 minutes prior to the arrival of the ambulance. So, Chauvin had his knee on his neck for several minutes after he apparently was dead. So it's especially grisly, but I think that makes it even worse, personally.
Real quick, next 30 seconds, I'm going to have to wrap up. How difficult is it to prosecute police officers? You've done it.
It's tough. I mean, it helps here to have the videos, for sure. The challenge is going to be the causation issue, as the professor mentioned previously. That follow-up medical examiner report, you know, is going to be critical, especially with respect to toxicology. I saw that the family wants to have its own autopsy, and I wouldn't be surprised if the defense has one too. So potentially you could have three medical examiners giving three different opinions at the trial. You could have a battle of the experts, and that could create a problem for the jury. We'll have to see how it plays out, but I'm very concerned about it.
Okay. Glenn Ivey, thank you so much for your expertise, former Prince George's County State's Attorney. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more of this discussion about a killing in Minneapolis, the George Floyd incident. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm gets underway on WHUR. We will have more of this discussion at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810 on SiriusXM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our look at the police in custody death of George Floyd. My guests are Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. And now we're joined by Nikki Mayo, President of the Baltimore Association of Black Journalists. Earlier today, we heard from Minnesota Attorney General and former Congressman Keith Ellison. He was talking about finding solutions to the historic pathology of racism at the heart of this story.
We're not just going to fix the windows and sweep up the glass. We're going to fix a broken, shattered society that leaves so many people behind based on their historical legacy of being in bondage and servitude, then second-class citizenship, and now fraught with disparities from everything from incarceration to housing to wages to everything else.
Before we get to that point, there was a poignant moment this morning involving CNN reporter Omar Jimenez. Now, Omar Jimenez is a young reporter who was doing his job reporting on the unrest in Minneapolis when he was arrested by state police officers. Nikki Mayo, the National Association of Black Journalists has condemned this. The governor has apologized. But from your perspective, as a veteran journalist, having covered all kinds of things, what was the first thing that you thought about when you saw this video?
My knee-jerk reaction was fear. And that's because we know Omar here in Baltimore. He worked at the WBAL, which is the NBC, the Hearst station there. So he had been very instrumental in just being good with outreach and whatnot. So I know him well enough to be afraid for him. For those of your listeners that have never seen him before, he is a very tall black man. He's Afro-Latino. He's dark-skinned. He's got broad shoulders. He played basketball for Northwestern. He's a young, big black man. So my initial reaction was fear, because he was taken to police custody in an area that we know is hostile. Minneapolis, St. Paul, that entire region has a very recent Black Lives Matter history, going back to Jamar Clark and Philando Castile. So I was, the gut reaction was just fear. I just wanted to make sure that they kept the cameras rolling, not just on his producer and his photographer, which were a Hispanic and a white male, but as they took him further and further away, I couldn't breathe for a second there.
Yeah, and for those of us who are familiar with, you know, Omar, because I live in Baltimore, I watched him on Channel 11 at the NBC affiliate mm-hmm. here. Yeah, he is, and you could see it today during his arrest. He is a mild-mannered guy.
Very.
Yeah.
Like, extremely soft. I mean, I can't say soft-spoken, but extremely mild-mannered, very preppy a little bit to that point. So it's kind of like, if you can envision it, somebody who you know went to a PWI like myself, he's going to be very slow to take any type of rapid movement because he knows what's at stake right now. And that's what we saw. And that's very commendable considering you're looking at a very cub reporter under 30 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the other things that we heard today, we heard it on CNN, mm-hmm. and Omar even said so when he was being debriefed by Wolf Blitzer, the CNN anchor, about what was said to him. And he said the state police officer said, when he asked, why am I being arrested? He said the officer said to him, I don't know, man. I'm just following orders. And the interesting thing was at the same time, there had mm-hmm. been no other detentions or arrests of any of the other reporters, most of whom, the TV reporters, most of whom there that we could see were white. So it raises some questions in my mind, and I'm sure it raises some questions in your mind and also Dr. Carr's mind.
They told on themselves 100% because Josh Campbell, another CNN reporter, a white male, by the way, they also approached him, asked him why he was there. He showed his identification the same way that Omar did. In fact, I argue that Omar probably showed his a little bit longer. We have video of Omar being questioned right there on camera for about 6 minutes as to who he is, where, you know, who does he work for. He's, you know, he's trying to show you that he is a reporter. And that badge should have been enough identification plus, I don't know, a microphone and a photographer and a third person who you just don't know what they're doing. There was enough there to indicate this person is definitely working for a network television news operation. They disregarded that. So, yeah, they could say they were following orders all they want, but you didn't take in Josh Campbell down the street either.
Yeah,
he was left alone. So they told on themselves right there. He was profiled, and I don't know if he was targeted because CNN is not that, you know, popular with some conservatives.
Dr. Carr, your thoughts about that incident?
No, I'm just listening here, and it's good to hear your voice, Sister Mayo. And also, thank you all, everybody at the National Association from Black Journalists, for putting out a statement specifically about Brother Jimenez. I know, you know, most of us saw it either as it was unfolding or shortly thereafter in the wee hours of the morning. And we all know that anxiety. If you've been Black in America and had a confrontation with the police, and there are a lot of people who have, then, you know, this brother, I mean, first of all, when you couldn't see him, he was off camera. If you didn't know, he might sound, as we would stereotypically assign that voice to a white man. He was very calm. He said, hey, we're following what we're doing. And you could see this creeping menace of these fascist police. And then, as we just heard Nikki Mayo say, as we heard her say, he's pulling out identification. And I've been in that situation when you've got every kind of damn ID you have in your life trying to
yes.
spread them out like you've got a 52-card deck to
yes.
prevent yourself. And the fact that that brother maintained his composure as he was being arrested, I think is a testament not only to his calm and cool, but what bothered me, and I'd like to hear what you had to say about it, Nikki, is that these white reporters at camp, the anchors, are narrating this, obviously with concern, but it's almost, they're not quite voyeurs, but there needs to be a sense of outrage, because this is how fascism emerges. When you
because,
try to narrate
yeah.
something, this is indefensible. And so, Nikki, how do we deal with this? How do journalists deal with this? Not just journalists, but human beings. No human should be arrested.
Now, I will admit, I'm starting to lean a little bit fringe because I'm starting to buck the idea that we have so much objectivity that we can't see blatant wrong and that we can't humanize the situation. What happened to Omar is despicable, and we see this happen with young Black men all the time. But for some reason, they can always disassociate those black guys from the beloved one that they had right there. The irony with Omar, as young as he is and, you know, as mild-mannered as he is, being accosted by anybody's law enforcement is the fact that, like, 2017, we just had him on a panel for, it's called the Black Male Media Project, where we talked about retaining and recruiting black men in the newsroom. It's going to be kind of hard to do that when you have a lovely live newscast from CNN showing that you can be at that level and still be profiled on national television and walked away while your colleague, who should also be detained, is over here reporting. Like, yes. that's not the hardest sell right there. And we're constantly trying to recruit these young people to go into J school and to tell the story. But if your managers are not going to stand up for you, if your anchors are going to be so confused or so just stuck in, I have to be objective. If that was a dog being yanked up in the middle of Central Park, I'm pretty sure they would have showed some emotion really fast.
Yeah. And you know, too, in defense of CNN, and Omar spoke about this, Jeff Zucker, the president of CNN, made some calls to the governor literally as this was happening. He was saying that he found out later that even as this was going on, that Jeff Zucker was on the phone with the governor, and there were moves to make sure that not only were they released, but they were released safely. Jimenez did say that, you know, all of the crew, not just him, but all of the crew eventually were sitting in a police vehicle, handcuffed, and then they were taken downtown, and they were detained for, you know, a total of about 90 minutes or so before they were released. But I think this goes back to the very issue of why did this have to happen in the first place? And I think that's something that there are still some questions that need to be answered, specifically about what happened to Jimenez, because the officer who arrested him said, "I don't know, man, I'm just following orders." Orders from who? But the other thing that I think we need to discuss was, you know, the comment during the press conference today by, you know, former member of the Congressional Black Caucus, Keith Ellison, who is now the attorney general for the state of Minnesota. You know, Dr. Carr, you know, there's some pretty high ideals expressed to him about, you know, trying to move forward and address the historic racial pathology in this country that we are literally living through right now with the death of George Floyd.
Yes. Well, we've never stopped living through it. We have to understand that the police function in the United States of America comes directly out of enslavement. The roots of policing in this country have the foundation in the control of black bodies during enslavement. Immediately after enslavement, with the so-called slave patrols, and tried to enforce what eventually become the Jim Crow laws, the role of the police in this society are to maintain order through, if necessary, violence. That's why when you hear that so-called abolitionist movement in this country to say they want to abolish the police or abolish policing, what they're really saying is we have to dismantle the attitude that the police are there to protect property and to impose order, at least when it comes to non-white citizens. And there's a deputy kind of form of whiteness that allows any random white person to assume some valence of that role, meaning they can call the police at any time on any of us, woman, a man, child, and have them impose order through, if necessary, violence. Now, you know, with all due respect to our brother Keith Ellison, and that's why I'm glad to listen to State's Attorney Ivy having this conversation. Generally speaking, state's attorneys, district attorneys, and others become defense attorneys for the police. So as you mentioned, in the charging document, they say that while he was standing up initially, Mr. Floyd began saying and repeating that he could not breathe. They go on to say that, as he said, the medical examiner's report indicates a number of pre-existing conditions, and there's no determination that the restraint by the police was the cause of death. Let's be very clear. Law enforcement's job is not to find the truth when it comes to police. Law enforcement's job traditionally has been to defend the police. They have put literally defense strategies into the charging document. And never forget, finally, that Muhammad Noor, who was given 12 and a half years, as we heard Ivy say earlier, was the first police officer charged and convicted in the history of the Minneapolis police force, and he was a Somali American who was charged with the murder of a white woman. Mm-hmm. And so I have no faith at all that this man will be charged, because will be convicted. The second-degree manslaughter charge, as you saw from the charging document, that penalty, if convicted, is up to 10 years and or a $20,000 fine. So, yes, Keith Ellison can wax eloquent in terms of his commitment to rhetorical justice, and justice would be this man being alive. But at the end of the day, the facts tell us something quite different.
Speaking of waxing eloquently, the former president, Barack Obama, tweeted a rather lengthy statement about the death of George Floyd. But one of the more poignant parts of that tweet says, "This shouldn't be normal in 2020 America. It can't be normal. If we want our children to grow up in a nation that lives up to its highest ideals, we can and we must be better." But, and certainly it is vintage, you know, Barack Obama, Dr. Carr. But, you know, I would only challenge that. Whose children can we expect to grow up in an America of highest ideals? Is it my child who is no longer a child? Is it her child or my child's child? When might we see, and what must we do to live up, in your opinion, to those high ideals?
Well, one thing we need to do is stop pretending like there's these false equivalencies. Never forget July 2009, President Obama's friend Henry Louis Gates was arrested on the porch of his house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, by a cop, a sergeant in Massachusetts, James Crowley, who was responding to a 911 caller's report that somebody was breaking into the house, and it turned out to be Henry Louis Gates' house. But let's also be clear that what happened after that? Barack Obama and his vice president, Joe Biden, invite Sergeant Crowley down to the White House for the beer summit so they can sit and talk their way through. No. So you'll forgive me if I take a hard pass on Barack Obama lecturing anybody about something he could have done something about when he was, in fact, president, and his attorney general, Eric Holder, was really chomping at the bit to enact even harsher what eventually come consent decrees out of the Department of Justice. And no, Obama was a moderating force when he was president. He should have done a little bit more when he was there.
Nikki, how do we cover this going forward? To me, this is almost, you know, we have, even though there is going to be and forgive me because I momentarily have brain lock, a curfew tonight for Minneapolis, St. Paul, 8 o'clock, but the anger is still there. You have people who are feeling an immense amount of pain, and yet we have, you know, this bigger, you know, issue of these protests, the violence, the shootings, for example, in Louisville, when people were also speaking out against the shooting of Breonna Taylor by Louisville City Police. Do we just continue to talk about the what is happening as it's happening? Are there not bigger issues that we must, as journalists, look at to give this context?
Oh, there's a ton of issues that we should be looking at, Don. Do we have the workforce for it? Have you not seen the economy lately? Have you seen
how
we're cutting down jobs left and right? So these newsrooms are without teeth and without claws right now, and it's hard to be a watchdog and the, you know, person that's like pointing out what's wrong with the world and how we must cover and fix this stuff if you don't even have the manpower in there. I just told you, Omar is under 30 years old and he's on CNN. These newsrooms are getting gutted like fish. And sadly, when you look at like some of the issues and the rinse, repeat thing that we're doing when someone is slain on video, we protest, we march and repeat. That's getting tired. I'm happy that, you know, more people within, I guess, pretty much my generation are just like, we're tired of the kumbaya curfews and let's all get together. And they're demanding changes. The sad part is that the journalists that tell those stories are so marginalized within their newsrooms that they almost become fringe if they beg that we need to do these stories. You know, there's no reason why. I think about two nights ago, they had something called the Revolt Summit, and it had Black News written on it, and you had, like, Amy Schumer on there or something like that. And you had, Van Lathan's okay, but when you looked at that panel, you're scratching your head like, what was the thought process behind any of this? Mm-hmm. And those are people who are parading as news organizations right now. I'm sure they meant well, but I'm just a little concerned that when you have legit news organizations, you marginalize and you almost make the people of color in your newsroom assimilate to the point where their voices are muted, and then this rinse repeat thing keeps happening. We know what happens to us, and if anything, we saw this morning, Omar was a Black man standing street. He wasn't a reporter. He was a Black man in the street, and he got profiled and pushed away just as quickly with the cameras rolling. That's happening to our reporters when they're not all gussied up in their makeup and their suits all the time. News managers need to acknowledge that, protect, and also advocate for the people on their staff. In real talk, most of us do not have the luxury of having our general manager or our network boss calling the governor's office. Many times they're doing golf with the governors, and that's it. So we don't have a voice anymore. And it's more of an accusatory reaction to, well, what were you doing wrong? So a lot of things do not change just because you have the title of a journalist. That is sad, because we have a lot of work to do right now.
Dr. Carr, we've been hearing a lot of the invoking of Dr. King this week, but we have also seen on social media some people, you know, talking about Malcolm X. Is this one of those watershed moments where some may honestly think that it's time for us to move from King to Malcolm X? And how do you do that and make an impact?
Well, I think that's the only way you make an impact. I think that's all. I mean, everyone who is a member of a family, whether it be Breonna Taylor's family, whether it be Ahmaud Arbery's family, or in Atlanta, or even now, who sheds a tear when they're put on white commercial news entertainment journalism, they get a hard pass from me. You do what you need to do. But all the crying Black commentators and the frustrated, heartbroken Black commentators, you know, to quote Malcolm X, you're speaking a language they don't understand. In other words, when you're appealing for your humanity to a group of people who have clearly shown either they will actively work against you or stand passively by, which is why, again, I certainly respect the young white protesters in Minnesota, Minneapolis, of which the majority have been. But they're the exceptions. A lot of this white fragility is silence. And Dr. King spoke out against it, for sure. But let's never forget, and both of you know this history much better than me, the reason that you get someone like an Omar Jimenez, the reason that you get a Nikki Mailer kicking in doors, the reason you get a Harold Fisher kicking in doors around the country, is because in the wake of the murder of Martin King in 1968, when all those cities went up in flames, it was mass action that caused these white news establishments to go out and raid the Black press for Black reporters and bring in a generation of new Black reporters. And so if we don't remember the history, and I'm talking about history that can go back to the 19th century. Ida B. Wells, 33 years old, when she wrote a red record and said, they're lynching us and we need to leave, Mrs. Or you come forward to 1919 in the Crisis magazine after the Red Summer, when people are writing in saying, finally, we're fighting back. What you find is when Black people decide enough is enough, it isn't the one or the two in the boardroom or on the staff making noise that makes it change for the masses of people. It's when enough people get together and say, burn it down. And the threat of that is when you finally see institutional action. So, in fact, Dr. King, I finally say this, Dr. King, and where do we go from here, Chaos or Community? The last book published posthumously, ironically, he says, if you don't listen to these people in the streets, he says, a riot is the language of the people who have not been heard, then this country is going to go up in flames. So in some ways, King and Malcolm really aren't two sides of a coin. They're saying many things that overlap.
Yes. There's a book that's called The Dream and the Nightmare, Martin and Malcolm. I think it's like James Cone or something like that.
Yeah.
That really does bring them both together. And I kind of cringe when you said a little less Martin, more Malcolm. Because keep in mind, when they gunned down Martin, he wasn't exactly the apple of everybody's eye.
Yeah. That's right.
So, and on Dr. Bernice King, even, like, she tweeted out a couple hours ago, it would be great if the folks who were as zealous about invoking my father to eradicate racism as they are about invoking him to criticize how people respond to racism when people talk about looting, when there's such a hyper-emphasis on property and buildings and not bodies, humanity. Like, folks like to use King like he's a saint, but they forget the parts that he was advocating for that preached the humanity of black people.
I want to raise one more issue in these last few minutes. One of the things that we've been seeing a lot of on social media, Dr. Carr, is this campaign for black people to not spend any money on July 7th to make a point. I'll tell you what I think. I don't think it wouldn't make much of a difference at all, because, first of all, America has been through one of the worst economic disasters in its history. And so a day of black people, even if everybody didn't spend money for a day, America would shrug it, because there hasn't been a whole lot of spending money for the past 2.5 months because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the other thing is that I would also argue that with all of the marching that we have done, to send a message. The message seems to me to be to preach to the choir, because even the great Million Man March was great for black people, but white people weren't really listening, and we can see that black men are still getting killed. What do you think about this July 7th campaign not to spend any money?
Well, it'll be easy for me not to spend any money on July 7th or any other day with these institutions. But I'll say a couple things very quickly, tying completely to what we just heard with your mail say. Dr. King, if you remember, in the wake of the shootings of Mike Brown and Tamir Rice, the shootings of all these women and men, there was a call to boycott Christmas, redistribute the pain, back in 2015. Mm-hmm. And the speech that was used to trigger that movement was a speech from Martin Luther King, one of the last ones he gave in Cleveland, Ohio. And he was like, we need to stop spending money with these businesses while our people are suffering economically. So I think it could work, but it won't work without organization. And we're simply not there yet. We don't even remember 5 years ago in terms of these notion of boycotts and Black Fridays. So, we have great spending power, but we talk about it as if we are organized. If we were organized, it might have a chance of putting a dent in. But no, I don't think it will be effective at all.
Yeah. Nikki, your thoughts about it?
I mean, I'll cover it if it happens, but I do just kind of disheartened. I work in the black press. So, every time I cover one of these things, I'm like, all right, is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And you're always like, oh, so close. So, yeah, I don't believe it's going to have any legs to it, primarily because there's too many people that will always do the, well, what about, like, they got a better plan. And that's the sad part. Like, you don't have a better plan, but you want to blow a million holes in the ones that are attempting to do something. The other thing is, they need to be careful about a lot of these allies and these passes they keep throwing out. Because, I mean, I get it. You don't see alone. There's everybody come together for kumbaya. I get it. However, some of these allies and these people you're giving passes to are very counterproductive to the goal. And they might need to meet you on the other side of this goal. That's just my thought.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a great way to end this discussion. Certainly we send out prayers to the Breonna Taylors and the families of the George Floyds and so many other black people who have lost their lives in the way that we saw George Floyd lose his life this week. And certainly we continue to do the work to talk about this, to bring attention to it, and hopefully find light at the end of a very, very long tunnel. We got a lot of work to do in this country. Dr. Greg Carr and Nikki Mayo. We also want to thank Glenn Ivey for talking to us. And as always, we ask you that you do your best to stay safe. That is the Daily Drum for this Friday, May 29th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Millette Green, Bramante Bryan, producer Candace Atkins, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Be safe, everyone. Good night, and have a wonderful weekend.